From the basketball court to your radio for Thursday, March 30th, 2017, this is the Perpetual Notion Machine. I'm your host, Will Cushman. The Badgers might be out in a heartbreaking fashion, but March Madness continues. On Friday and Saturday, the final four men's and women's basketball teams will play to determine who will face off in the final games of the 2017 NCAA College Basketball Tournament. So how's your bracket doing? Maybe a better question is, why are we discussing basketball on a science program? Not to fear, my nerdy friends, because tonight we'll be talking about March Madness and other fun topics through the lens of mathematical reasoning. Tonight's guest is Laura Albert McClay. Albert McClay is a professor of industrial and systems engineering at UW-Madison. Her research focuses on modeling and solving real-world discrete optimization problems with application to homeland security, disasters, emergency response, public services, and healthcare. She is also interested in sports analytics and bracketology, which is what we're going to focus on tonight. Tonight, Albert McClay will tell us how we could have produced a better March Madness bracket with the aid of, you guessed it, math. We'll also discuss her research and how math could aid us in all sorts of everyday decision-making. Laura, welcome to PNM.
Thanks for having me.
So I guess jumping straight into it, how's your bracket doing?
It could be doing a little bit better, but the tournament's not over, and Gonzaga might help me win it all. We'll see.
Okay. So I guess I am not a college basketball fan, I guess you would say. I mean, I don't really follow it. I've filled out brackets in the past, but I didn't fill out a bracket this year. I'm wondering if you could either walk me through how you determined your bracket using whatever methods you use, superior methods, or tell me like how I could do it if I were to go back and do it.
Sure. One thing to keep in mind is that when I fill out brackets, I recognize that the math can only get me so far. So having a good process where you look at a lot of numbers and crunch a lot of numbers will help improve your chance of winning your pool, but it's still mostly randomness based on how they do the scoring. And so that can be the frustrating part of doing your research and still losing, which is usually what happens to me. And vice versa, doing your research and losing to somebody that just randomly fills out a bracket. And that's just part of the process. But if you were to do this over the long run, math will definitely help. So I'll tell you a little bit about how I get started. And first, I look at some rankings that are out there. I produce my own, and I contribute them to a rankings aggregator where I can see where teams are ranked. And I might look at some tournament probability models and simulations, like 538 has one. Well, they'll give you a probability that a team might win. And these are all things that I use to recognize who might be win, which upsets might happen. So sometimes the lower seed is actually favored to win, and so I usually pick that team as an upset, but technically speaking, the lower seeded team could be favored.
Wait, so why would that be the case?
Well, there's a couple reasons. One is that the seeding process and the creating the bracket process is really hairy. There's so many constraints, and you know, there's the mid-major teams versus the teams from the major conferences. And so sometimes like a weak team from a major conference will get a higher seed than a really good team in a mid-major conference.
Okay.
And the actual matchups are, you know, a little bit different than what you might think. And so records can be very misleading for that purpose too, because they have very different strengths of schedule. So that's kind of tough. And then there's a lot of constraints where in terms of location, and certain teams can't play each other in the first few rounds. And so it's the selection committee actually reserves the right to move a seed up or down a spot or two to actually make the bracket look better and to obey all these constraints and to protect the distance for the top seeds. The top four seeds are supposed to have like a home game in the first round.
Gotcha.
And yeah, so the bracket, the creating the bracket to begin with is a very imperfect process, and the seeds are just guidelines for how good a team may be.
Gotcha. You mentioned the website 538. That's the kind of like data journalism website by, yep, Nate Silver, right? That people are probably pretty familiar with, either sports fans, or if they followed the election at all last year. Mm-hmm. But I guess what else do you like use programs or people are about to realize how naive I am when it comes to sports and math. Like, okay. Do you use formulas when you put this together, or is it mostly like I've got a hunch?
I use formulas for the rankings. I don't use formulas when I'm actually figuring out my brackets.
So okay.
Perhaps I'm a bit of a fraud. But I do try to use a lot of mathematical reasoning, and I try to get inside the head of my friends in my pool that are also very mathematically minded. So one thing is, based on how the scoring work, you get the same amount of points per each round, but every round further in the tournament, there's half as many teams. And so I also try to think strategically, like who should be in my final four and who should win it all. And so one thing I figured out last year that was actually pretty helpful. So last year, I think there were a couple of favorite teams. I think Kansas was one of them. And I decided not to pick the favorite team to win it all. And so you don't know who your opponents are choosing in their bracket, but you can look at like ESPN and they set up a who picked whom, and you can look at some statistics there, and then you can see, well, everybody's picking Kansas. So if I pick Kansas to win it all, I could still lose my bracket just because, you know, we all pick Kansas and some first round pick, you know, made the difference. So I try to pick like not trying to pick bad teams to put in the final four, but maybe some slightly undervalued teams that are way up there at the top. And so I kind of corner the market. And because it's going to be random at the end of the day, so I want to be like the sole winner when something happens versus having to maybe lose because we all pick the same thing. So that's one thing that I found to be particularly helpful, is focusing on not just identifying who's going to win, but just identifying how to beat my opponents a little bit.
Gotcha. And so I guess that kind of leads into my next question, or more kind of observation. The last time I filled out a bracket was a couple of years ago in my office, and I did it completely randomly. And I had several coworkers who like spent a ton of time. Mostly, I mean, there was a lot of, little bit of kind of like they had a couple of like favorites, and then but then they also thought that they knew college basketball really well, and we're going to pick a really good bracket. But then my random bracket ended up winning the office pool. And so is that kind of – and it was mostly because there were a couple, two or three upsets that really surprised a lot of people, that I think my bracket, just because I didn't know any better, I just chose the really worse off team. So is that kind of playing into what you were just talking about, where it's – I mean, maybe I was a little bit extreme in picking teams that probably had very little chance in winning, but you don't necessarily want to pick the team that everyone else is picking.
That's true. Yeah. And it's super random, and they specifically designed the scoring systems to, you know, reward that type. You know, you don't need to be an expert to win your pool. So that is one thing that makes it more fun. And that's why so many people participate every year.
Right. Right.
But I try to do my research, but not so much that I hate it. I'm done. And I'm mad that I lost. So I try to enjoy it too.
Gotcha. So the people, you said the people that you're in the pool with are also pretty mathematically minded. Who are they, your coworkers? Or
mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah. So does your pool then, is it pretty, it must be pretty competitive, just in terms of, I guess, both like competitive with personalities, but then also just like, I imagine that you all probably have pretty superior brackets a lot of the time.
You'd think. this year, that's definitely the case. I think we're all above the 50th percentile in ESPN. So we've done pretty well. But it's good natured. We have a lot of fun with it.
Cool.
Just win bragging rights. That's it.
And I guess I should have asked this right off the bat, but could you explain what bracketology is?
Really, it's I don't know if it has a strict definition, but it really is defined by the bracket in the March Madness tournament. But
okay.
I think, you know, I think about it a little bit more generally in terms of ranking teams throughout the season and thinking about basketball in an analytical way. But yeah, most of the time it's just applied to the tournament.
Are there other sports that you're into in terms of just like sports analytics? Like,
sure. Yeah. I'm a huge football fan, professional football. And so that's how I first got interested in sports analytics, of just that you could understand how to make optimal decisions during a football game using math. This was the greatest idea. And I dove right in and I started crunching some numbers myself. And then when the first college football playoff was about to start 3 years ago, I started ranking football teams and then trying to simulate the rest of the season. It's so interesting in college football because the playoff is only four teams as opposed to 68 teams that are in the basketball tournament every year. And so I really wanted to identify who would be really the best four teams. They're way at the tail of that distribution. And, you know, the path to the end of the season to really be among the best is pretty tough for different teams. And the strength of schedule really matters. And a team could be undefeated, but if they have a hard schedule that's remaining, you know, they might not be very likely to make it. And I wanted to look at that a little bit. And so that's been really fun. I've done really well in the first three college football playoffs, and I try to forecast who I think will be in it. And you can see when there's a big upset, like I guess it was two playoffs ago when Michigan State beat Ohio State, you could really see that that shook things up in terms of the numbers.
Gotcha.
So it's kind of fun to do.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's interesting, too, because Wisconsin's always really great, but the Big Ten West is not as strong. And you can see that that can be a secret advantage because it's easier to get into the Big Ten championship game. And that's always something really interesting to me, too, because I listen to all the talking heads talk about these things, but I can math it out. And that makes me more interested.
Yeah, no, that's cool. That's really cool. So I kind of want to get into your broader research now.
Sure.
So I guess how does this all relate, your bracketology, sports analytics, how does this relate to your research and what you do as a professor at UW?
Oh, sure. I'm not taking methods that I use in my everyday research and applying them to sports.
Right.
But there's a lot of commonalities. So my field is called operations research. It's maybe not the best name, but it's this field that grew out of World War II, and it was designed to like move troops around. And when you make those decisions, there's all these interconnected parts and moving troops and supplies on a network. And they're really expensive decisions. And if you can make small improvements in your operations, you'd save a lot of money because war is expensive. And a lot of the things we do in operations research today are involved with things like transportation problems and delivering packages around the world, but also a lot of other problems. So I've looked at some transportation problems, too. I do a lot of work in optimization models for responding to 911 calls and also looking at things for Homeland Security. So designing policy models to understand how we should screen passengers for aviation security. So these are the types of things I like to look at. A lot of my early research was on Homeland Security, and we didn't have access to real data. And I really felt like I was missing out on that part of my research. You know, there's a lot of different methods that we use in operations research to make better decisions. That's what we're really focused on. And we'd like to do that in a very data-driven way when we can. And so there's a math modeling part, but there's also this data part. And I wanted to learn a little bit more about the data because my research, you know, really couldn't do so at the time. And so sports was a great way to sort of fill that gap and get me interested in different aspects of the problem. The students, you know, don't just analyze a lot of historical data. That's not just what we do. We actually do a lot of that work of statistics and understanding data to actually make data-driven models to guide decisions. So we're very forward-looking. That's what we do as engineers. We're about designing better systems, and it's kind of looking into the future and designing a better future.
Right.
So I try to tie it all together, and it's sports analytics has been great because I get to learn new things and have a lot of fun along the way. I'm a little bit more comfortable with the numbers.
Yeah, no, that's really cool. So I guess so. You mentioned optimizing like 911 response. So I guess what does the data look like, and where do you get it from, and then how do you throw that into a model and come out with recommendations, optimizations? Like I guess could you kind of walk through that process a little bit?
Oh, sure.
More?
So I have community partners for that, and I've looked at a lot of call logs for data of how long it takes to drive to a call and respond to a call. And a lot of my work looks at where to locate and how to dispatch vehicles to calls. And so when they are dispatched to calls, they serve a patient. And if they take them to the hospital, they're gone for a long period of time. And There are different types of resources. So you have paramedics or you can practice medicine at the scene. You have EMTs. And the county I was working with was looking at deploying quick response vehicles, which are basically SUVs. The problem is an SUV can't take a patient to the hospital, so they'd have to double up with a different ambulance. But usually you have two staff members in an ambulance versus one in an SUV. And so now you have all these different types of vehicles, and you have to figure out how to send the right mix to a patient. And some patients have different needs than other patients. So there's a part of it that's about getting it right. And, you know, optimization is a great tool for that. So it was helpful for research. It also helped motivate the deployment of this QRV program in this community in Virginia where I worked at the time. And that actually made a big difference in terms of community health. And it was actually awarded an award for its implementation. Cool. So it was pretty neat.
Yeah. What does QRV stand for?
Quick Response Vehicle.
Okay. Gotcha. Yep.
Yeah. Just an SUV, really.
Gotcha. That's really cool. And then you also mentioned optimizing, like how we screen at airports.
Yes.
So that's something that I think most people are all too familiar with and maybe frustrated with sometimes. So what could you talk us through a little bit how you're hoping to optimize that situation, get us through quicker?
Yeah. So I started my PhD in September 2001, and I started working with Sheldon Jacobson at the University of Illinois, who, believe it or not, had been working on aviation security problems before September 11th.
Okay.
He had this great vision, and he got involved because Al Gore was this visionary, and you know he invented the internet and got us interested in climate change, but he also was this visionary with aviation security. And there were some issues, especially after Pan Am Flight Light 103, about a bomb went off in a checked bag on a plane. So there was there's big interest. I shouldn't say a big interest in aviation security, but there was some interest, but it wasn't very popular at the time because aviation security seemed so safe. So when September 11th happened, I was looking for a research project. I kind of was in the right place at the right time. And we started looking at risk-based screening in very resource-constrained environments because it was very resource-constrained at the time, although that quickly changed. And how do you really get the most bang for your buck if you can't screen everybody with everything? And we really don't want that. I like to go through aviation security without a huge hassle.
Right.
And so we really did a lot of that work and kind of advocated for risk-based screening. It ended up doing less with more, really, trying to really target the resources at risky aspects of the system instead of making us all wait in really long screening lines. Yeah, so I think hopefully it's made a difference. And I liked that the TSA has actually reduced some level of screening for things that are obviously not too risky in terms of letting young kids keep their shoes on and so on.
Right.
I think these are all good things that I think my research would support.
I'm also wondering how you mentioned how you don't necessarily, getting a little bit back to brackets, you don't necessarily mm-hmm. use math or put numbers into formulas, models, whatever. Like you don't necessarily like crunch the numbers when you're coming up with your bracket, but you said like mathematical reasoning.
Yes, and I also rely on other people's crunched numbers to look at like game win probabilities.
Okay.
That's my goal for next year is to come up with my own. So there will be there's always some number crunching that goes on.
Okay. What are some areas in our everyday lives where maybe just anyone could apply some of this reasoning and maybe someone else's crunch numbers to improve some aspect of their like everyday life?
Oh, everyday life. There's a lot of things you can do in everyday life. So.
Yeah, sorry. That's like a huge, broad question.
It is a huge problem. So one of the ways that I think about math modeling is actually just sort of getting out the door in the morning. So I'm a mom to three wonderful little girls, and it is really complex, all the things we have to do in the morning. And so you can actually model that as using network optimization models, and it's like project management. You have to find your critical path through the system. And there's always like something that's the bottleneck. You have to keep that moving to get the project going, to get out the door on time. And so that's what we do in the morning, is I try to figure out what we need to do next. Usually it's making sure everybody's eating and getting shoes on. And then everything else we just kind of do as we can. But I really try to focus on the most efficient way to get us out the door in the morning. So that's pretty complex, but it's also helpful for my everyday life.
Oh, totally. And for your sanity.
For my sanity. Right. Exactly. Yeah. And there's other things, too. I mean, so when I do my rankings, they're based on Markov chains.
What's a Markov chain?
It's a mathematical model that studies how a system evolves over time. And so they're often used to model like the behavior of the stock market. So they're used widely in finance and also epidemiology to look at the spread of disease. Like you'll have the diseases has follow a certain pattern, and Markov chains can help explain and understand that. The actual details of the model, you know, are very specific to ranking sports team, but the general idea of the Markov chain is actually used in Google's PageRank algorithm, which probably changed all of our lives. Before Google's PageRank, you know, you'd search for something and you wouldn't get such great results. But they really used that. This algorithm could understand if you typed in a search term, it would be better identify where the knowledge could be found and who the authorities were on that subject. So we're talking about sports now. So if you typed in sports before, you would just get, I don't know, some GeoCities account or something. You know?
Yeah, something awful.
Yeah, something awful. But all of those, you know, GeoCities fan sites would link to something like ESPN or Yahoo Sports and so on. And so they were like voting for the website. And so that's what teams do when they play. They sort of like vote for the team that beats them. It's a very similar idea. And so they use the math model to actually understand and quantify where the knowledge could be found on the website. And then if you rank those sites, you get, you know, the top searches that come out. And that was incredibly helpful. It spawned this incredible industry that we had. It all started with Markov chains. And so we can do the same thing with sports teams, too.
Okay.
So I know that's my plug, is that, you know, I'm just trying to get students, and I'm actually teaching a course in sports analytics this semester. So we can do a lot of fun things with sports. But if you actually, I really want to introduce them to new methods and new ways of thinking about problems and sports in this case. And I'm hoping that they apply some of these ideas to other domains when they graduate.
Yeah, yeah. What else are you – I didn't realize you were teaching a course on that this semester. That's really cool. What else are you covering in the course?
Oh, sure. It's a course on sports analytics. We have descriptive analytics, which is mainly statistics like linear regression, logistic regression. We did empirical Bayes of how to draw conclusions with very limited data. By using kind of initial beliefs that you have. And we are also looking at predictive analytics. So we're doing some probability models. And like, will this hockey team win the game if they're up by one with 3 minutes to go? And today we analyzed volleyball scoring schemes to see how long a match would take. And then we'll do prescriptive analytics, which is really the optimization modeling. So I mentioned how hard it was to come up with a bracket and obey all these constraints. Well, right. We can formulate that as an optimization model and solve it. We can look at tournament scheduling models. And we'll also look at things like when your favorite baseball team is mathematically eliminated from the playoffs. We can use some network models for that.
And so you mentioned 538 and Yahoo Sports and ESPN. Are there other resources that you would recommend for people who want a top-notch bracket? Maybe they failed with their bracket this year and they want to redeem themselves next March?
Sure. I recommend the Massey ratings. So first of all, Ken Massey has many, many rankings, including mine, aggregated there. So you have a lot of information. He also has all the game data. So this is where I download data to crunch some numbers on my own. So if you want to do that, you have all the data that's right there. It's a great source of information.
So what is that called?
Massey ratings.
And how do you spell that?
Massey.
Okay.
You can Google it.
Yeah.
It'll come up pretty right away. Thanks to Markov chains. It's fun for me, too. I'm not a trained statistician, and I've picked up a lot of things on my own, and understanding it through the lens of sports has really helped me understand a lot of these methods a lot better.
Mm-hmm.
It's helped me be a better citizen of our data-driven world.
Cool. Laura, is there anything that we haven't covered with bracketology or your research or anything that you kind of would like to make a plug for or that you think we should have covered?
We could talk about perfect brackets if you want, but...
Oh, yeah. That is something I was wondering. Like, it's a very, 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 very low probability that you'll have a perfect bracket, right? Like, what's the... It's minuscule, right?
It's minuscule, yeah. So there are 9.2 quintillion ways to fill out a bracket. So that there are more ways to fill out a bracket than there are stars in our galaxy. So there's a lot of ways things can go wrong. But yeah. Luckily, you don't need to get that many right picks to win your pool. But it's very, very challenging. And it's gotten a lot of interest because Warren Buffett's offering so much money to anybody who can fill out a perfect bracket. And it's hard to really estimate when that could happen. I think in the last 50 million or so brackets at ESPN, there's only been one that's got the first... that got the first 32 games correct. So it's the half. There's 63 games that they count for this. So the first 32 correct. So one out of 50 million. And that's they get halfway there. Right? So only one thing has to go wrong in the bracket for teams to lose out.
Right.
And it's interesting to see year to year how hard it is. So we didn't have too many upsets in the early rounds this year. But some years there are hundreds of thousands of people that get all four final four teams correct. And some years it's just single digits if there's a Cinderella story. So you can really see that year to year, you know, your odds of getting a perfect bracket actually depend on what happened and how surprising the tournament was.
Right.
This was kind of a tough year because there wasn't an overwhelming favorite. So I think we could have one within my lifetime potentially, but we'd need a very... easy to pick year.
Gotcha.
For that to happen.
Yeah. Do you know roughly how many brackets are filled out every year?
I don't. I have just looked at some of the numbers on specific sites, but there's so many that have them.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's hundreds of millions.
Yeah. The perfect bracket would be one in how many again?
There's 9.2 quintillion ways,
okay.
But a lot of them we can rule out. So there are various estimates from, I think, from maybe about one in a trillion to maybe just one in like 100 billion. So now we're getting, if you get fill out 100 million brackets every year, now you can see that this could happen.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Eventually, somebody might do it.
Right. Why can we rule out so many of the options?
That's a good question. So, for example, a 16 seed has never beaten a 1 seed. And... So we can rule out a lot of options, or we can rule out some very unlikely situations, like probably not all 2 seeds are going to go down in the first round.
Gotcha. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, it would be exciting to see a perfect bracket. I remember, I think, when I was a kid filling out a bracket and thinking, like, it can't be that hard to get it all right. But I guess.
It's pretty tough.
Yeah. Cool. Well, Laura, I think we're about out of time. So thank you very much for joining us this evening. Really appreciate you taking the time.
It was my pleasure.
We want to thank everyone who listened tonight. This has been another edition of the Perpetual Notion Machine brought to you by the Madison Science Radio Collective. Thanks again to our guest, Laura Elbert McClay. She's a professor of industrial and systems engineering at UW-Madison. Our show tonight was engineered by Pete Berg.